LEDs, huh?
Because LEDs are only starting to get worth it. Because the LEDs look like LED lights for a really long time. They're only starting to figure out the soft white.
Well, all right. But these, do these heat up, though?
Yeah. Right. Check in like a minute.
The LEDs don't, though. That's what I'm saying. The LEDs...
Mike, I'm aware. We have LED lights, too. I'm cheap, so I go to Lowe's or Home Depot and buy
saying,
the cheap pack.
As much hardware as you have in this little space, and as much as I suspect cooling is a priority for you in here, I would think you would have the cooler.
Oh, no, they don't produce heat.
Oh, the CFLs don't produce heat.
No, I thought you meant they need to warm
up. No, that's what I'm saying. They don't get hot.
No.
They don't get hot. Okay.
I have this massive computer. I don't know if you've noticed it.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I know
that produces heat, but not for everything.
Giant, vax system in here. What was that original computer called? I can't. ENIAC? Is that it? I think.
Before my
time.
I'm going
to say ENIAC.
To ENIAC.
It's like a Trivial Pursuit question.
To ENIAC.
To ENIAC.
Built by a Brainiac. Who worked for Aflac.
This is a tasty drink.
Mm-hmm. Wow. You know what we need to do? When we hit episode 100, we need to end this fucking podcast and open a bar. But before we open the bar, we have to go back through the podcast and listen just at the beginning of every episode when we talk about how great our drinks are or how awful they are and be like, that was a unique drink. We should make that a drink at our bar.
Yeah, I would make this a drink at the bar.
Yeah.
We should come up with a name for this because it's got some cool stuff in it.
Dude, oh my God, we need to release a Buddies in Space drink, like mixology book. Recipe book. Seriously.
All right.
Like 20 or 30 of our best cocktails?
I'm down with that. This would be on the list, though, for me. This is really tasty.
Okay, so it's muddled organic Harry's strawberries, which
yes.
are cut above regular strawberries.
Yeah.
These ain't no Driscolls.
They're pricey. They're pricey.
They look gorgeous. And then it is the maple syrup.
It's from Black Squirrel Distillery, I believe, in I think it's in Buffalo, New York.
Okay.
And
good name.
It is a barrel-aged spirit made from maple syrup. It is not sweet.
No.
You get kind of the maple hint to it.
You get the body of maple. You get the essence of maple, I think
you
said.
Yeah, but it's not sweet like you might expect with a maple syrup.
Now, if you know anything about alcohol...
It's more like a rum, kind of.
Yeah. Right, which makes sense because rum comes from sugarcane, traditionally. But it's not actually sweet. So if you know much about alcohol, you know that sugar from, sugar and carbon dioxide, it's a process, right? So the sugar is eaten.
Yes.
As part of fermentation. But yeah, I'm sure a lot of people would expect, oh, maple syrup, yes, it's going to be sweet, but it's not at all.
So we got that. We got some fizz ginger beer, or is it sip? I can't remember.
No, that was fizz.
Fizz, okay.
Sip comes in the really tiny bottles.
Yeah.
That was a fatty.
Right. Relatively speaking. And just a little splash of the black walnut liqueur.
Right, but then that
it
added
did. It really... I was a little skeptical, but...
Skeptical.
But your experiment proved a success.
I just had to go with the gut, and the gut said,
"More
booze."
The gut, I go with the gut. I went with the gut for this because we took a recipe from the Black Squirrel Distillery website, which was basically doing a dark and stormy with their distilled maple, not liqueur,
liquor,
maple spirit, I guess
spirits.
Sure, maple spirit. I like that.
in lieu of
rum,
right?
And I had it with the lime and a little bitters, and it was good. But then I had one of the strawberries that Erica had,
the cheesecake stuffed strawberries,
and it went really well with my drink. And I was like, you know what? This needs strawberry and not lime.
You had like an epiphany too.
I did.
Like you were sitting down there, right? You were sitting down in the basement. And you were like, not sure if it's the drink or the booze or not, but. This strawberry goes really well with this drink.
and it does. This is an excellent drink.
I kind of like maple spirit as the name, but I guess that's not as descriptive enough.
The maple squirrel berry? I don't know.
Mm. Maple berry.
Maple berry squirrel nut?
Zipper?
No.
That'll get us sued.
Ah. Well, we can come back to that.
Strawberry fields forever? Also get us sued. Damn it. Hi, we are Buddies in Space. You are?
That's Michael Smith, and you are...
And Michael Carassi.
And we have no guests tonight.
None. We are guestless for the first time in 3 episodes.
Feels weird.
It's been exhausting. So many mouth sounds to edit out.
We talked a little bit. We touched on it.
Boop.
We touched on it. We touched on the movie that we saw, which was Doctor Strange.
Yes.
Finally. After everybody else has probably seen it.
Yeah, I feel like we're free of spoiler territory. Yeah.
So, I think it was an entertaining movie. I didn't get a lot out of it.
It didn't have a lasting...
It didn't have much depth to it.
No.
It was like weird. It was pretty.
It was a drug trip movie.
Had some, yeah. It had some nice visual moments. The villain was just a villain. It was like generic Doctor Strange.
Like two-dimensional cardboard villain. Cutout villain.
Yes.
Yeah. Like, I want to death.
Yes.
Something.
I want everybody to die and I'll live forever, I think.
I think. Maybe. Purple eyes.
And yeah.
Boogie, 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 boogie.
And really overdone mascara. And that was the villain.
Again, I'm assuming everyone's seen it at this point. So, like, knowing Baron Mordo's relationship to Doctor Strange, it was fun because the whole movie I was watching that relationship, trying to figure out what was going to shift it.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, it made sense. I thought that and the Stinger, like, did it for a Marvel movie. Man, come on. This isn't Shakespeare.
Yeah.
But I thought that it was like, oh, okay. So they really let that take its time to get there.
Yeah. And I will give it credit. They... a lot of movies, when they do the like time travel or time manipulation thing, it gets kind of old and cheesy and stupid. But they did find a nice twist with him going to whatever Dormammu and having the loop going there. It didn't make a lot of sense, but it was a fun bit.
It was like he really did the heroic self-sacrifice thing with that because he was just getting fucking obliterated yeah. over and over, like squashed, crushed, shot, pierced multiple times over and over again.
But that was a nice bit that they had.
Mm-hmm. I agree with that.
It was a nice little clever and entertaining bit.
That's what the movie was consisted of. It was clever and entertaining bits.
Yeah.
Without... a strong, like, unifying backbone.
And Tilda Swinton was Tilda Swinton. I mean,
that was the equivalent of her phoning it in, which is still really good.
Yeah, it was.
It's like
it was her just being her, really.
Yeah, I have a skull cap, or I really shaved my head. She probably really shaved her head. I really shaved my head. I'm Tilda Swinton. By the way, motherfucking mystical powers. And peace. I'm out. Pay me.
And she, I thought she was really the highlight of the movie. Even her phony the scene when she died, and that was all very, I thought that was all really nice.
It was poignant. Well done.
Yeah. Her whole speech about, you know, I've never been able to see, I've been able to see the future, but I've never been able to see past right now.
This moment, yeah. I didn't actually think it was that
good. Well, it was a nice moment.
It was a nice moment.
So the one of the problems I have with this is how the fuck, in a character sense, not in a logistical sense, but in a character sense, what is the point of having Dr. Stephen Strange in the Marvel Cinematic Universe? What does he bring that isn't already there?
Magic.
Yeah, but character-wise, personality-wise... I mean, he's kind of like a watery down
Tony Stark. Yeah, no,
without
I absolutely agree.
The drug problems
in real life, yeah. and in the movie. No, that's a valid point. I mean, there's a lot of erasable, redeemable man children in the Marvel universe. They've sort of done that already.
Yeah,
and they've done the genius, the gifted genius, with a fatal flaw.
Yes.
Thing that mm-hmm. they has to move past. Like, yeah, there's very little original about him, and you're right. That's a good point.
Yeah, and a lot of the other characters, I can see, okay, yeah, this is different. This one brings some contrast. I like Ant-Man.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think Paul Rudd's character is a nice contrast to a lot of the others.
It was good casting, and it's a good contrast, absolutely.
But Cumberbatch's Doctor Strange, I don't know. I don't think he brings anything... that really stands out to the table.
I wonder if it's a spaghetti at the wall. Hey, we did this. We didn't think Guardians would go anywhere. And it was a mega awesome success. So we'll just greenlight anything at this point.
Yeah, but Guardians nailed the characters. I mean, they got this whole, you know, cast of a very interesting, I don't think diverse is the right word, but.
Well, it's a team dynamic that is very unlike the Avengers.
Yes.
I mean, that I thought that would... But
James, they're all very distinct characters. You know where they're coming from.
And a lot of that's on James Gunn.
Okay.
I have to give him credit because... And this is why I'm so excited for Thor with Taika Waititi. Having comedic directors... I mean, James Gunn did, like, Slither. You know what I mean? Like, he brings such an oddball sense to it that I felt that really let those characters develop in a way that, you know, the whatever brothers who are doing, you know, they did a good job of Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
But that was like a Marvel blockbuster movie in your face.
Yeah.
You know.
And you got the characters that were already pretty well-defined in previous movies.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It seems like there's a good format to, hey, let's have like a out of left field director for this genre come in and launch a character. And then we'll hand them off to continue them with someone who is doing more of the blockbustery thing. But, in retrospect, like, I really enjoyed Doctor Strange, but I think Doctor Strange for me was probably, like, episode 7 for a lot of people.
Yeah.
Like, if you think about it, it doesn't really hold up.
No.
But you can enjoy it at the time and be like, all right, unless you're me, in which case you hate episode 7. But we're diverging. So, yeah, I'm with you. I'm desperately looking forward to Guardians 2. I don't know when I'm going to see it.
As am I. haven't seen it yet, but yeah. So we should probably dive into this.
Ooh.
So we watched another movie. We watched a movie a couple nights ago.
Yeah, we should start. We need to unpack this. I need some therapy because I was reeling the next day too.
I could not get the movie out of my head all night. I was dreaming this movie. I didn't even know I was dreaming. I was like, it was just there in my head while I was sleeping.
While you were sleeping?
Yeah. With
Sandra Bullock?
Ugh.
My wife thought that was funny. She's laughing right now. So the movie we're talking about is Mike Birbiglia's Don't Think Twice. A little background here, just if you're not familiar with it, because it's not a big budget, high profile movie. Mike Birbiglia, really great stand-up comic, improv background. Very good friends with Ira Glass. Name that most people should recognize from the podcast world. So Mike Birbiglia, I believe, helped Ira Glass launch his show, and Ira Glass has collaborated with Mike Birbiglia. Sleepwalk With Me is an outstanding movie. It's about Mike Birbiglia having REM behavior disorder, I believe it's called.
Huh.
He acts out his dreams.
Okay.
And
that sounds neat. I haven't heard of that one.
It's horrendous. In the movie, he pulls a lot of real experience, and in the movie, he dives out of a second story window.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
So wait, this is actually, he actually has this?
Yeah. It's his like fictionalized, overly comedic take on what he went through. Very, very, very good movie. And like, it had a cameo of this really old, like, pioneer of the sleep research field. So my wife was like fucking geeking out. Not unlike how we were geeking out watching Don't Think Twice. So Mike Birbiglia, great comedic chops, does really interesting projects. He did a movie about improv, and it got a lot of good buzz in, like, the indie kind of review circuits, and we wanted to see it. And Erica, like, forever ago was like, we should see this. And then you, months later, were like, we should see this. Sort of funny. It missed.
So we finally did.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was a very good movie.
Mm-hmm.
My wife wasn't happy with it, but it was about actors, so...
Oh, that's a particular
like movies about actors.
Painful point
that's
for her,
That's not a happy subgenre for her. An interesting thing for me was that there was very little improv in the movie.
Yeah. I mean, no. In the plot, there's a ton of improv.
But there isn't. I mean, there are not, like, a lot of scenes of them doing improv. There's, like, maybe 5 minutes of that at the most.
That, I think for the average audience member, that's probably going to seem like a lot.
Okay.
Again, take off the smite goggles.
Okay.
And look at it as the average person.
But
that improv was not...
It was not improv.
Right.
I mean, it was all scripted out.
Mm-hmm.
And it was... It was really well done because the improv scenes were definitely them saying a lot of stuff that
you would say
they couldn't otherwise say to each other.
Mm-hmm. It went the raw aspect of it.
Yeah.
So it's a funny movie. It nails to the wall.
I don't. It has. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
What?
It's funny, but like, but dark and
that's my perfect
nasty lady. And
nasty.
Got a little brooding in it and a lot of, you know.
It has. You can tell that the person who made it has lived it. you know what I mean? From what little I read about it, Mike Birbiglia has it, that similar history with SNL. But for me, having spent years on and off in the New York City improv scene. Which is where it takes place.
Yes.
It nails the shit out of it. To the point where it, like, I would have been drinking a lot. But it really kind of started to fuck with me. Because, like, it was, like, unpacking all sorts of, like, good and bad sense memory of my time doing improv in New York.
Yes.
And I was like, oh, my God. Like, it basically wrecked me by the end.
Yeah. And I think I told you after we watched it, I was kind of on a tangent to that scene. I was living on Long Island at the time when I was out there, and I was going to school out there. And I was a graduate student, and I was directing an improv group there. And I was also working as a stage manager for a guy who was very much like one of the characters in the movie.
Mike Birbiglia's character.
Yes. Yes. And this is the guy, I don't want to name names, but this is a guy who, he had his training in Chicago. He'd been in a couple of very well, highly thought of, well-known within improv circles, mm-hmm. improv groups. And now he was out in New York and he was trying to build up his own thing. And he had his own group.
On Long Island.
In New York, in Manhattan.
Oh, okay.
City,
so you were stage manager. So he was there. The
yes.
Okay.
Yeah. So
that makes the story less sad.
No, I mean, it was like he was in that and you know, he had his very close-knit group, and I was just kind of like on the fringe of that. You know, I wasn't in the group mind, but I would like hang out with them sometimes.
I want to know who it is. Well, I'm going to go on mute here. I don't know who that is. Never mind.
That's all right. So yeah, and a lot of the stuff that I saw with that group, and a lot of, you know, stuff that I've just picked up from going to the various improv festivals and things, it is that mentality. And the sense is that there are some people who are doing improv because they love doing improv,
mm-hmm.
but there's a lot of people who
a
are in it.
A lot of people.
Who are seen as a path, mm-hmm. or like, I'm going to get noticed by somebody, which is Second City, mostly.
Well, in New York, it's usually Saturday Night Live.
Well, yeah, but I mean, yeah.
Depending on where you are, yes.
Yeah, Second City is kind of the feeder for Saturday Night Live.
I knew people who went to Saturday Night Live right out of the New York improv scene.
Okay. That's more, yeah, I think that's more the case now. In the past, it was like Second City was kind of a feeder, but I think over the years, it's become more, as there has become more of a scene in New York, an improv scene. And that's happened like over the last, you know, 20 years or so.
Yeah, and that actually aligns. So Erica was looking at the history of SNL, and she was telling me that the Adam Sandler cast mm-hmm. almost ruined, like that was one of the lowest points of SNL, because they couldn't work together. It was a bunch of big personality stand-ups.
Mm-hmm.
And so Lauren Michaels, like, after that cast, like, Will Ferrell
mm-hmm.
and, like, all that crew who were all improvisers. And that was when that started to happen, when all of a sudden there was a lot of improv in SNL.
Okay.
And it had one of its, you know, multiple renaissances with that group. So that's probably around that time.
Yeah, yeah.
So that makes sense.
Yeah, the improv scene in New York is relatively recent. I think probably like 25 or so years.
Yeah, that sounds right. But it's huge.
It's huge now, definitely. So yeah, there are people that they come there and they're like, I'm going to get into training. I'm going to get into the pit. I'm going to get into UCB, whichever one of the two.
The Magnet.
Probably not both.
There's the Magnet too.
The Magnet. And I'm going to get noticed and I'm going to get on Saturday Night Live. And then I'm going to get my movie deals, I'm going to get a TV show, and then I'm going to be done.
Mm-hmm. I don't want to do improv anymore.
Yeah, why would I do improv? I have the stuff that I really want.
Right. The fame and the fortune.
Yes.
Yeah, the movie really did a good job of... I mean, again, I really believe Mike Birbiglia is very familiar with this. The archetypal improv character people, you know, the improv types, right? So you had the kind of creepy director who had been doing it a really long time, who was good at it.
Yeah.
But, like, was trying to pick up his students, sometimes successfully, and really wasn't living that glamorous a life in his lofted dorm-like room.
I may have associated a little bit too much with that character. Nice. Yeah. That hit a little close to home for me.
Ooh. And then he had, like, the prodigy who really was doing it because she loved it. The guy who was in it more for the writing. The rich person who was doing it because what the fuck, why not?
Yeah.
Who then ended up having a success, which seemed unfair, but... and then you had Key. Or Peel. Mm-hmm. Key.
I think so.
I think it was Key. I love Key and Peel. But yeah, so Key was the one... The one.
Yes.
Who, and definitely seen this before. The minute an agent or someone, a casting agent was in the audience, he would just fucking try to own the stage. I knew so many people like that, and it pissed me off so much. They had go-to characters, and they'd break them out when they knew, when, you know, when the moment was right, so that they'd look better than everyone else at improv, even though I thought it was cheap as shit. Like, there's a moment really early on when Mike Birbiglia looks at him, and he goes, well, that's actually not improv, that's a prepared bit. And I was like, it's right. Fucking right. You tell him. But yeah, it was so for me.
And it seems pedantic, but it's really not.
No, it's really, really not. And it's really, really important to note that. You can be a very gifted comedic performer, but if you have a stable of characters you fall back to constantly, that is not improv. And I think it gets harder over time to not do that. But that's why you keep challenging yourself. And, like, when I found myself doing it, I felt like shit, you know? Like, I genuinely was like, this is not cool. But I was in... So I started UCB in...
Which is Upright Citizens Brigade.
Upright Citizens Brigade, which is sort of the premier New York improv school.
Yes.
The first major one, started by Amy Poehler and the Upright Citizens Brigade, which was an actual improv troupe out of Chicago. Or was it L.A.? Some of them might be Groundlings. I want to say
Chicago.
I think some of them went to the Groundlings, but I think they're out of Chicago. Groundlings is the improv school in L.A. I was there. I was young. You know, I had dipped my toe into college, into improv in college for a couple of years and directed our troupe by the end. And, I knew I was good at improv, like, from a cerebral sense. And I took the first two classes at Upright Citizens Brigade, and I really enjoyed it. I had good teachers.
So let me take a step back.
Yeah.
And then... We may get a little painful here.
Okay.
Because I'm going to come right at you.
Like a spider monkey.
Like a spider monkey.
Put that axe down.
So why did you get into improv?
Because I saw it as a means to an end.
There you go.
Yeah. Absolutely. and it was very purposeful. As I was getting close to graduating, I didn't go to conservatory. I went to a SUNY school. So I said, what are the path that people are making to the movies? I wanted to do comedic, you know, comedies. So I looked at Will Ferrell was really popular at the time and that kind of cabal of actors, and they all did improv. And I said, I think rather than trying to go the straight drama route or the comedy stage route, I think improv is the way to go here.
Yes.
And I had an affinity for it and I had some level of skill. So I said, that's the way I'm going to go. So, yeah, I went when I was, out of college, it was Upright Citizens Brigade, going to do the four levels, going to do some master classes and then do my audition for SNL. That was my original intention, 100%, when I was like 22.
So you got there, you got into the program, right?
There's no getting in.
Well, okay.
Yeah, they just take anyone.
Right.
There's nothing special about it.
I didn't mean that in the way that, like, you managed to get in, but, like, you get there and you get into the program.
I went there and handed them $250, and I got into the program, As in, I got into level one. And
there's no skipping, or they don't care what you might have done before.
But I ran into that problem later in my second time in New York, and actually found a discuss why I went with the magnet, because they were like, you don't have to take level one again. Actually, there's a whole story behind that. So I went through level one and didn't learn a ton, but had a good teacher who was in a troop that was, at that time, like, had been around 5 years and was one of the premier house teams.
So that would have been like the group in the movie.
The commune, yes. Mm-hmm. They were, I'm not saying their name, they're no longer together because those you know, troops have lifespans. Groups,
yeah.
They come and then they go.
Being together for 5 years is like, you've been together for a long time.
There's a lot of probably weird incestuous shit at this point. Yeah. How many of y'all slept with each other? it's an all-male troop? Again, how many of y'all slept with each other? Oh, none of you are gay? How many of y'all slept with each other? So I looked at that and I thought that, and that was the first time I thought, just doing improv for the sake of doing improv is cool. You know, like that was the first inkling I had. And then I had Owen Burke, who was my all time favorite improv teacher.
Mm-hmm.
He was level two. And he was the stoner who, I'm not saying Owen Burke did drugs. I'm just saying that Owen Burke was always high on life or marijuana. But he was the one who I've told these stories where he'd sit in the back of the room, arms crossed, head back. 90% asleep, but like if you look closely, his eyes were like open a slit, and he would like be leaning his head back so he could kind of watch you like this, just barely open. And he'd be like, all right, I'm just gonna do the scene because clearly he's not watching. And the minute the scene stopped, he'd shoot forward, be like, okay, about 1 minute in, why did you deny her dog at being a poodle? Why did it have to be a? And you were like, holy fuck. But he had the greatest analogies that I use in corporate America when I do soft skills training. He had the whole X-Men analogy. You've heard me talk about this, right?
Talk about it.
He's like, so when you are on a team, you are the X-Men. If you are a Cyclops, Wolverine's on your team. So guess what? You have his power too. And it was it was about group mind.
Mm-hmm.
But then he also had the, when he was trying to explain like just going with it, like just actually improvising and taking a risk and not knowing what you're going to say next, like the lack of, you know, forethought. He'd say, you know that scene when Magneto just walks out in the midair and just calls up the metal plates? That's improv. He's like, you just... and he cursed all the time. I love that dude to death. He's like, you just fucking step out in the midair and there will be a metal plate there. You fucking do it. He was great. And then I got really burned out in New York because I was doing the fine dining thing at some really rough restaurants and I ended up leaving. And then I met you guys.
Yeah.
Well, not after another really bad experience that I left to join you guys.
Yes.
And that was like, probably the best improv time I've ever had in my life.
Yeah.
Was that first year of Unleashed. Because it was like tons of rehearsal. Our first show was still the best show I've ever been in. From like an enjoyment standpoint, from an entertainment standpoint. And then I went back and I was a lot.
To New York.
To New York. So I was up here, met Erica. I was up here for 3 years, went back. In 08. During the recession. Awesome.
Mm-hmm.
But when I was there, I was much
was
more
this close
hip.
To, that was just like around a writer's strike too, wasn't it?
It was right after the writer's strike.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was just a bad 1-2 punch.
So not only were people not looking for, not looking to pay people, they were also like, yeah, we're just going to go with reality TV. We don't need actors, we just need people.
Reality TV was, at that point, still kind of edging out all other TV.
Yeah.
Like, the prestige Breaking Bads hadn't really hit yet, so there wasn't that. I feel like that's coming more into vogue, which is awesome. I had way more experience, more training. You know, I got it a lot better at that point. I'd seen good improv. I'd seen the power of it. So I went back down, and I was still pursuing an acting career. But I really wanted to get back into improv just for the fuck, you know, for the hell of it. I was auditioning for agents. I was doing it differently this time.
Mm-hmm.
And I went back to UCB and it was a Harold factory. And it might have been a Harold factory the first time and I just didn't pick up on it.
Mm-hmm.
But all of a sudden, that Usual Suspects ending moment, you go back and you step back and you think, oh, I walk up, I pay my $250, they don't audition me. They take my money and throw me into class with some truly awful people.
Okay, I think we need to break down what a Harold factory is, because I know what you mean.
I was building up to it.
Okay.
So, and then you learn about the Harold, which is the three-act structure of improv. So three games, three scenes,
it's
a group game.
And this is the quintessential long-form improv structure as created and developed by Del Close in, I don't know, like the
70s?
70s or 80s, maybe.
We'll say late 70s.
Yeah.
Should be, in between. It's a very powerful format.
It is.
There's a lot to the three-act structure that is, for whatever reason, ingrained in the human psyche. And that's UCB's bread and butter, is the Harold structure. But they just churned out Harold actors. And everyone went through the Harold program.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't even my... I mean, I didn't coin the phrase, but it was a Harold factory.
So you think the problem with that was that it's hard for any individuals or individual groups to really stand out in that
sort some of environment? Some did. I mean, look at Kimmy Schmidt. She's a UCB grad. She went through it, and she's obviously outstanding. But it was like so many other things that become saturated and sell out.
Kind of a cookie cutter-ish?
Very cookie cutter. Okay. Oh, you went to UCB, so you know how to do the Herald. That means that is the extent. That and $4.23 will get you a venti mocha cappuccino at Starbucks. It means nothing beyond that one thing. You know what I mean? It's like the associate's degree at that point. Mm-hmm. It's like, well, what do I do with this? And so I got kind of disillusioned, and so I went to the Pit, which split off from the UCB kind of for that reason. And we're trying to do their own thing.
Which is the People's Improv Theater. Okay, yeah.
And I talked to the head of the theater, who I also, like you, will not name. And, you know, I said, hey, you know, I have like 10 years experience. I've done multiple levels of UCB. You know, is there any way I can like start at level 2? I just want to jump back in. It just blew smoke up my ass for like 5 minutes about how important it was to start at level 1 at this theater. And I knew enough actors. There was no reason to do that. Mm-hmm. It was no different than level 1 anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, all right, peace. Like, I want nothing to do with this. So I ended up in the Magnet, and they were kind of like just all stoners. Like, it was just such a laid back vibe. And I kind of like realized early on, like, I don't think I'm going to go anywhere with this, like as a career move, but I really want to finish out a 4-level academy and like say, like I did the improv school training, which they all offer.
Right.
The 4 levels. Start with the basics, learn the Harold, get into specific styles, come up with your own, you know, that kind of thing. I like the vibe there. So I did it. But everywhere this movie was hit was things I experienced. The people who were driven by nothing but trying to get on SNL. You know, the people who were barely improvising, were just doing rehearsed bits.
Right.
And not disguising it very poorly. Like, it was so much like... I won't say nostalgia. It was just so much memory unpacking it in one small drunk moment of that watching the movie. It really was like, whoa. I think I guess I had not unpacked this enough previously. I wasn't ready for it.
So were you on? I don't think we ever really talked about this. Were you on a? I assume you were on a team at some point in New York. No.
I made a series of very strategic missteps.
So I know you were doing the Comedia thing, but that's not really a team thing.
It wasn't. So that was part of this weird improv thing, like a 40-person rotating cast improv society that had an inn at a very prominent stand-up club.
Okay.
Very prominent. Super prominent in the stand-up world.
Okay.
And they had a downstairs. That seems
weird because I say this as somebody who sat in on one of your rehearsals for the Comedia. And it was like, it was super artsy. That kind of like, well, we're doing an ancient form of improv with masks. And we're practicing our tumbling and... I don't mean to belittle you, but it was very, very artsy.
Avant-garde?
Yes, but sure.
The opposite of avant-garde. Avant-old?
Yeah,
the director...
It was a little head up your ass sort of stuff.
The director... Me specifically?
No, just... I mean the whole project, I think.
I was like...
And the which would be, really would fall on the director.
The director was like a... actual like Commedia, like he had studied it, I think, in Italy.
And... Well, of course, obviously.
Where else would you study?
The Commedia masters in Italy.
I studied from Mr. Commedia. He was from Canada. Yeah. It would... How much do you put on him, and how much?
And the for people who aren't familiar, the Commedia is all is like is, it's kind of.
Comedian is the grandfather of improv.
Is the grandfather of improv. So you would, everybody has a mask of some sort, and you have what are, ironically, what you were saying, this is an improv when you have a stock character that you've worked on.
It is all stock characters.
It is all stock characters that people work on. That's what Comedia is. It's all of these like archetypical sort of characters.
Yeah, Punch and Judy comes out of that pantheon of characters, and the really big nosed fop character. Like, I've forgotten all these names at this point.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're familiar with theater at all, a lot of recognizable character archetypes come out of Comedia.
Yes,
which is weird. Yeah. Comedia is weird. I've always been weirded out by mask work. I've always been weirded out by
it. And I think, for the record, I think mask work is really cool. I've had some really neat experiences with mask work. And I get it. I mean, I get that, like, putting on the mask, if you do it right, and if you, you know, take the time to work it, the mask brings out this, like, crazy character of its own. The mask has its own.
It doesn't even have to be crazy.
It's not you. It's not
the mask draws something out of you that is not you.
Yes.
I would be able to do it now. I know that because I recognize the things I put aside. But at the time, my control issues, which is ultimately, I think, the thing to help me back from being even a better improviser.
Mm-hmm.
But my control issues prevented me from really getting into that show. Mm-hmm. I didn't make my own mask. I didn't get it. I still get a weird, icky feeling from that. It's part of the cult thing. Like, some of the language involved with mask work is very reminiscent of some weird cult shit to me.
Yeah, I can appreciate that.
You know what I mean?
And it's almost animalism by design.
Well, I mean, it is literally by design because it comes out of that kind of thing.
Because if you're doing mask work, and I hesitate to put it this way, but I will, if you're doing it right, you are giving up control to the mask.
Well, the idea is that the mask has a spirit.
Yes.
And you become the conduit. Look, I mean, for those who aren't familiar with it, Comedia is weird. You never insert, when you're holding your mask, you never put your fingers through the eye sockets.
Mm-hmm.
That's a disrespect to the spirit of the mask. Like, we were told that from the director, like, really on, like, never hold it that way. And I have no reason to think that that's not a legitimate thing you don't do in Comedia.
I believe it.
It still weirds me out. But so that whole thing was weird. There was a big push to not do bringer shows. We were in a stand-up.
What?
I'm going to explain it.
Okay.
In the stand-up world, we were in a stand-up, very, very prominent stand-up club.
Yeah. So you got to, when you say that, you've got a strong expectation from the audience that whatever they see is going to be funny, and it's going to be funny right away.
Doesn't matter. Okay. You have a strong expectation from the owner of the club that you're going to bring in money.
Okay, that's,
specifically,
yeah.
People. That's what rules your life.
Yes.
So bringer shows are generally two people, two drink minimum. Or one person, two drink minimum, bare minimum. Usually it's two people, two drink minimum. That's what a bringer show is. So in the stand-up world, when you're starting out, you're hustling these bringer shows, and you're totally burning through your friend group. Because you're like, look, I need 5 minutes to try out my new material. I need you to come and spend like $30 on two drinks.
Yeah.
It's terrible. I mean, it's a terrible system. It's demoralizing.
Yes.
And we were in a very prominent club. And I keep saying that because I really want to say the name because it's very famous, but I'm not going to.
That's a whole other issue with the improv world is the money side, which they sort of got into a little bit in the movie. But I'm just taking a little sidetrack.
Okay.
And the thing about improv shows is when you're in that environment and you're in Chicago or New York, and I assume it's still like this, is like you're always trying to get your friends to come and pay money to see you do the funny stuff that you do when you're with your friends anyway.
That they just give you a couple of beers and you're doing it.
And 90% of the time, they're other improvisers.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Well, so you're everybody's paying to go see everybody else.
And after a point, I'm going to do a PSA right now. If you're an improviser and you're listening to this, stop thinking that Facebook events are going to get people to come to your fucking shows. Because guess what? They're really easy to disregard and ignore. And you don't know it, but they're doing it.
Aww.
No, it did not. Like, being a director eventually of a long form troupe, it did nothing to get us anyone. Like, I thought, like, oh, I'm doing Facebook events. Funny. They're kind of funny description. Didn't mean shit.
Mm-hmm.
Not shit. But it was a weird commune approach to improv. Mm-hmm. It was like 40 people, and the idea was try to bring your friends. We're never, ever going to charge dues. We're never going to charge dues.
Right.
But you still...
It's funny that you're saying it because, and even watching the movie, and like, the deals that they're working out are like, oh, we made the same deal. It's like, okay, we'll bring the owner of the house, we'll get the top cut of the money, and then if there's something left, we'll paid. We'll
make it, yeah. And then they're like, oh, the ticket's only $45. Oh, God. That was towards the end. Like, that really hit home, that whole thing. When they're doing that show for, like, five people in the tuxedos. And I'm like, oh, my God, this is me at the cave. This is me at that place in Long Island City that no one would come to. Because I was doing Facebook events. It was a cool venue, but too far out. Don't do your shows in Long Island City. They were adamant about not doing paying dues. But you had to kind of bring people. And then Erica usually bailed me out there, thankfully. but then I heard they eventually did do dues. And it was like, it was trying to fight a system that really, it was stacked against it. And the few time agents came, they hated the shows we did because it was a rotating cast of people. And like some, you know, people wouldn't show up for months for rehearsals. And so I eventually said, look, dude, I went to the director. You know, we got along pretty well. I was like, look, dude, I want to do long form. I hate this shit. This is all short form. I was upfront about that from day one. I did the Comedia show. I really enjoyed that-ish. I want to do long form. So we split off and we're like a subsect of them for a hot second, then just split off entirely. And
that's got to be a frustrating show for anybody who's trying to get noticed, because any talent scouts who come are seeing people in masks.
I think that was all resume building.
Yeah.
That was, how many chances do you actually get to do Comedia with, like, someone who studied Comedia in Italy?
All right.
Yeah, you know, I honestly...
That makes sense.
I want to do it for the experience, as an experiential thing.
Sure.
You know, no. The fuck's going to come and be like, a talent scout's like, you're amazing! I should get you in...
Mm-hmm. Oh, wait. Whoever's in that mask, I want them. You know what? No, just give me the mask! Give me the mask!
In the pantaloons! Take the mask off! I'm casting the mask. You're okay. I'm going to cast you in nothing because this is not a useful skill set. Clowning is actually more useful than that. Look at the guy from Legion. So, and then the long form troupe made a very good friend. Actually, Buddies in Space is because of that troupe, because of a friend I had in that troupe. And there were some very talented people, but I wasn't a strong director. It was hard. You know, I was working a full-time job. I wasn't focused fully on that, and I didn't let the right people in necessarily. Some people like should have been a little more like, no, you need to not be in the troupe. And that fell apart eventually, and it's like, it was what it was.
Like, you're never coming to practices, you have a drug problem, and
you do one character every single time. Yeah. Like, if you're telling from the tone and the story, like, my trajectory was just a very long downward slide. And it was one wrong choice after another. Just like the agents I went with.
Mm-hmm.
I auditioned for Abrams, which is a big commercial agency. And I was the one time I had a good audition for an agent. The one, because I worked with my acting coach and was like, she had me drilled. Like, I was fucking on it in a way that I've never been able to be since. And the woman was like, I want to sign you. And I'm like, oh, I have one more audition. Just give me that. And I went with, I auditioned for a little mom and pop that did legit and commercial. So they did fit casting for stage and film and commercials. And
Abrams, they did what?
They
you
were,
say fake casting?
They did, no, they did stage, film, and commercials. Okay. So legit, stage and film, commercial.
Okay.
And so they had an all-around representation. Abrams only had commercials.
Right.
And like an idiot, I went with the all-around mom and pop who fell up, as a company, they fell apart almost immediately and never booked me anything. And then when I went back to Abrams a couple of years later, she's like, I have like 10 of you now. No joke, that's what she said.
Mm-hmm.
I have 10 of you now. Why didn't you sign with me before? I still have the email somewhere.
Oh, you should delete that. Get rid of it.
No, it's a good reminder.
Aw. You don't need to be reminded of that.
I don't have any regrets at this point, but
shouldn't have any regrets. You have a great life now.
Movies like that bring it all back up, though.
Okay.
That's the thing. So it stirred the pot a bit. The dregs kind of floated up. The strawberries in my as yet unnamed drink are floating at the top. I want another one. Yeah, actually, I do want another one. All right. Another one?
I'm driving, but we can take a break if you want to make another one.
Let's go make another one.
Are we back?
Yeah.
All right. So you've reloaded on the drink.
I re-upped on the drink.
And we're maybe you want to come to wrap up your little therapy session.
What do you mean? You don't want to help me? Fuck you, Del Close. Wait, man, you're not Del Close.
No. But I did have the chance to meet him.
Mm.
And he was not in good shape when
it was towards the end, right?
Yeah. He was like sitting on the curb of the street in Austin, Texas, and just angrily talking to the traffic.
But was he drunk? Or that, because Del Close was crazy. That was just
the way he was.
Yeah, that was Del Close. He didn't have a telephone because he knew he would call politicians and curse them out. That's the story.
I believe that.
So my point was, I don't have regrets. And this is my big takeaway for anyone who's failed. Like, I always say I'm a failed actor. And I say it with a smile on my face. It's not I'm a failed actor. I'm not in a black beret and a cigarette in my mouth. It's, I tried something. I have a very good idea what I did wrong. I'm totally cool with not doing it anymore.
And I would say that, like, some absurdly high number of actors, of people who have said, yeah, I want to be an actor, I want to be famous, I want to get a TV show, I want to be in a movie. The vast, vast, vast majority of people who do that are like, this sucks.
It's rare that you realize that early on. And what really sucks is, I think, when you're, like, kind of past your prime, like, in the 40s, I think, is what, if you're getting out of acting in your 40s, it's like, oh, like, I know, I met, talk about heartbreaking. I met, like, a successful Broadway actress who still rents her apartment and who lives paycheck to paycheck.
Yeah, and that's the thing with, I was never in that. I never went that route, and I never went the I want to be a working actor route. I thought about it, but I knew people who were working actors.
It's miserable,
and they are. They are living paycheck to paycheck.
They're living the dream, which happens to be paycheck to paycheck.
Yeah, and I'm like, this no. I would like more money than that.
I don't need to be famous, and I don't want. You know what I've realized? I don't want to be famous. Fuck that. I don't even need to be rich. I don't want to live paycheck to paycheck anymore.
Yeah.
It's not great.
And for, you know, for some people, they're doing it and they love it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, great. God bless them. And
very few of them love it all the way to the end.
Yeah.
And
you don't think so?
I don't think so. And the ones that love it too long are fucked. Because when you're in your 50s and you realize you're over that shit, what do? You're not going to go to law school. You're not moving in with mom and dad. They're probably dead. Maybe I'm being a little fatalistic, but you get my point. But no, I really don't have regrets. I am mature enough to have looked back and said, ah, these are the strategic mistakes I made. I can pinpoint those pretty accurately.
So can you, when you look back now, can you say, I did the New York actor experience. I've done that. I lived it, and
not really.
No,
because I was always trying. I was always working full time as in lucrative waitering jobs.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that
isn't the New York actor experience.
No, well, it is now because the rent's so high. I talk to a lot of older actor waiters or actor whatevers because you all have a survival job, and they were all like, "Yeah, you know, in the 70s and 80s, like the really old ones, were like." You could make bracelets and sell them on the street and pay your rent.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you did not need, it was literally a survival job that took up very little of your time.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the big shift. That's the whole David Byrne thing. That he wrote that article, like, is this an old rich white man city? I'm an old rich white man and I want to leave, kind of thing. New York City is priced so extravagantly high that you can't make it as an actor and be a starving artist. And that's pretty integral.
Yes.
Because you don't get that artist community vibe when you're working 60 hours a week.
Yes. And there was, and people remember from the gubernatorial race, however many years ago, a few years ago.
The rent is too damn high.
The rent is too damn high party.
Totally
and
legit.
It was kind of a joke, but
based on a very true.
For anybody who'd been in the city or you know tried to have a rent to rent something in, certainly in Manhattan.
Park Slope.
Yeah.
$18.35 a month for a one bedroom, 500 square foot, third floor walk up. $1,835 a month.
Yes. The rent is too damn high party has a legitimate complaint.
Complaint, yes, absolutely.
It's a big deal. Very big deal.
The important thing is I can say I tried it as much as I was going to try it, and I'm fucking over it. That is 110% accurate. So I look back and I never once, honest to God, not once in years have I looked back and thought, oh, I should go down there and try it again. Not once. Because my loathing of New York City and what that town has become is so fierce to this day that I don't like going back, even to visit friends. Certainly not for work. Thank God our office is slowly dying there, so I don't have to go there. I just hate that city. So, but there's a lot that came out of it that's awesome. And this is what's cool about improv.
Mm-hmm.
If you get even mediocre improv training, no matter where the fuck you are, there's some amazing life lessons that come out of that. And I've always said, the yes and principle is beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
It helped me a great deal. Letting go of some control issues. Group mind. Like, all these things, putting ego aside, you know, I'm not saying anything that hasn't been well documented at this point. Like, improv is a thing a lot of people dip their toes in because it's known to be a character building exercise.
Yes.
I was talking to a lawyer not that long ago. We were talking about that. He's not an actor at all. He's like, yeah, we're all encouraged to do it. You know. So I think it's a beautiful way to spend some free time. Very few people go into improv to make money, and you're stupid if you do. Just call it what it is. There's a lot of bad improv in the world, but there's a lot of good to come out of it. So that's my takeaway. That's my therapy.
So you like it as a process. You like it as a tool.
I like it as a pastime.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's fun. You get a high off of that when it's good. I mean, seriously, one good scene, fucking, that's you can't bottle that shit.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah, you remember that. But, yeah, trying to turn into a factory model, trying to make it a commune, charging money to do it. The hustle ruins everything. It really does. And that was kind of what I really liked about the statement about success in Don't Think Twice.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it seemed like everyone who was working for the SNL-esque show were fucking miserable. And the Lorne Michaels character was really weird.
Yeah, that was a hilarious moment. It the bicycle.
The bicycle was great.
That was killing me. I like the movie a lot. The one thing, and this might be a spoiler. I won't spoil it too much.
That movie kind of movie's hard to spoil.
Yeah.
The narrative
I thought the ending was too upbeat. I thought it was artificially upbeat.
Yes. I absolutely agree with you.
And it seemed unnatural given all the character arcs. I mean, I could see the upbeat ending for some of them.
Some of them, but not all of them.
But it was like they kind of wrapped everybody up in like a little bow.
Yeah, it had a button. It had a very pretty button, and you could just be like
oh, this
done.
Character did this. She finished the thing she'd been working on.
Oh, character development.
She's okay
you're
on
a better
her own
person.
Now. And it was like, because I certainly appreciate the one guy, the director guy, who's like the creepy, I'm sleeping with my
or trying
students.
To, which is even creepier.
Or trying to. And I thought he had a really nice character arc.
Yeah, well, Mike Birbiglia.
Well, okay, he was a director. I mean, he's going to give himself a good arc, obviously. But I thought his was really nice because he was like he went back and he got involved with someone, someone more age appropriate. Not that there's anything wrong with different age groups getting together. But
it rarely works.
It rarely works.
I did like the way they did it felt somewhat organic.
That did. That character arc felt organic.
Like, just was like, you know so much about me. He's like, oh, I'm just getting started. Like, that was like, oh, that's cute. It's like kind of older people being cute. All right. And by older, I mean 40s. No offense.
Yeah.
Well, because cute, the ingenue is normally like a 20-year-old. So it was cute to see like someone who was an adult doing being cute.
Yes.
Is what I'm trying to say.
Mm-hmm.
And trying to say cute way too many times in a sense.
But yeah, his character came that realization like, yeah, this is really not, this is stupid for me to be doing this.
Yep. Still clinging to my claims and
And he found a much more healthy, I guess.
I think that's what life. It is. Yeah, absolutely. You shouldn't be, you know, bartending in your 40s. You should be staying up to 3 a.m. doing bumps of coke with your customers, and I don't care how lucrative it is. That's not. I mean, you shouldn't be doing coke at all, but you shouldn't be that kind of. This shit's bad for your body.
Yes. But every character, and they were like, there were some moments where they were vicious to each other, and that all sort of got
kind of washed away at the end.
Washed away at the end. Yeah.
No, I'm with you. It had that weird fantasy element towards the end after, like, some, if you're in the scene, some hyper realistic aspects to
it. And, like, this is our relationship would be over after some of these things happened. Like, you just really fucked me over, and I don't ever want to see you again.
Yeah. Oh, hey, it's so good to see you, and I'm being genuine right now.
Yeah. Anyway, otherwise, an excellent movie. I would highly recommend it. I'm After sure all nobody's going to get the same thing we got out of it.
Yeah, that's the thing, is to be completely fair. Like, Mel...
But it got very good reviews.
Very good reviews.
And I think good audience... Except for, you know, my wife.
But that's the thing, is you really, like, our cross-section of people was very odd. So
yeah.
The only one to come away with that, thoroughly enjoying it, not shaken to their core or to some degree, was my wife, who loves Mike Birbiglia.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a very funny movie, and it's well done.
Yes.
Your wife's hang-up had to do with it was a film about actors.
Yeah.
And she does not like those. She doesn't like actors.
Yeah.
I was having...
Which is legit. That's fine.
That's totally fine. I was having my own little meltdown, you know, recollection. Whatever. You were having a lesser version of that.
Yes.
I think the average person watching the movie is going to be like, this is a really funny movie. What are those fucking weirdos and buddies in space talking about? Holy shit. Bunch of prima donnas. Jesus Christ. Go see a therapist.
Hey, this movie is giving you nightmares? What the hell's wrong with you?
I laughed a bunch. Good God. That Mike Birbiglia fellow. He's hilarious.
The thing with the bike. I loved it.
He had the dorm room speech, like, memorized.
The dorm room speech?
When he was bringing a girl.
Oh, yeah, room. Yeah, yeah.
It was
yeah.
always the exact same delivery, jumped into the bed the same way. I was like, wow. That's great.
Yeah. I don't want to talk about that.
We have just enough time to talk about calibrating televisions.
I haven't done it yet. I just got it. I haven't had a chance to.
I almost... Okay, so...
I thought about doing it tonight. Before coming over.
Oh, that would have been like, awesome.
I need a little...
No, you need time.
I need the time. I need
you
time.
Need, you need to give yourself a good hour the first time you do it. The second time you do it, it's really quick. But I almost want... So, okay, I'll take a step back. So, got the fancy TV.
The curved TV.
The OLED is the primary selling point. The curved is the hypocritical part of it.
Mm-hmm.
Fuck you. Fuck you, Del Close. I knew that I had to be calibrated. I thought I could buy like a fancy calibration system. You really can't. They're just astronomically expensive. So I looked on the ISF forums, inadvertently calling them IFC for a while, so I apologize. But the professional calibrators forums, and they all agreed on this one Blu-ray, which was weirdly expensive for a Blu-ray.
Yeah.
The Spear is like $30. But it's Spears and Munsell. Everyone said it was good, so I broke my TV in for over 150 hours. Did it, and it made a huge fucking difference. And when you're calibrating, it doesn't seem like it's going to.
Mm-hmm.
But Erica, who doesn't notice shit about shit when it comes to like different formats and HD, like all that
kind of
stuff.
And I'm sure you mean that in the most loving way.
Absolutely. Well, the payoff is that she was like, this looks way better. And I was like, yes! She doesn't care. I totally respect it. I'm like, look at these infinite black levels, baby. She's like, I can't see as well. This doesn't look good. This doesn't look as good as the 10-year-old Sony. I'm like, So I want to set up a camera like fly on the wall to watch you, because I feel like this is going to be somewhere between crack and porn for you. Because the degree of like subjective fine tuning that this allows you is dangerous.
And I'm a little scared because I know how many different settings my fucking plasma TV has.
But you want a lot. You're going to stick to the basics. You're going to do the contrast, the brightness, the sharpness, all that kind of stuff. That's why. What did I tell you to avoid?
The advanced section?
I looked at you, S. Michael Smith, and said, don't do the advanced section, which is the bulk of it.
Just which, of course, leads to me like, I should probably look at that advanced section.
You're going to look at it, and it's going to be like looking at somewhere between the
Necronomicon. Is it going to be like that in the Mouth of Madness?
Yes.
He looks like shoves his head into the book.
You're going to pop back up. You're going to have hair for a split second because it's going to be all crazy. And it's going to fall off again. You're going to be like, your side hair is going to be gray. So, yeah, it's something wicked kind of thing. Yeah, just stick to the basic stuff. But I so want to like watch without you knowing you're being watched, because I feel like you're going to like go through the first test and like, oh, yeah, okay, it's contrast. This is easy. And then go to brightness and you're like, I can get that bar a little bit darker without it going away. Okay. Oh, I have to go back to contrast now and check.
Yeah.
Oh, I have to go back to brightness now and check. Yeah. And then you never get past the first two tests.
I know. I know that'll happen.
I know that'll happen. Like,
oh my God, I can set individual red, green, and blue levels? Fuck me, man. This is going to take forever.
Don't go down that path.
I'll be doing this for the rest of my life.
Sharpness is actually the worst. Because I'm sure your TV does it too. My TV does vertical and horizontal sharpness in the expert mode. So
it's, well, have you done this on your plasma?
On my plasma, no. I actually had a professional calibrator.
Okay.
Come do it with a camera and shit. But I'm sure it's similar. But the OLED, again, I mean, you have a high end plasma.
I think it's like the same plasma you have.
No. Yeah, no. We have the V series. Yeah, you know the V series. I think you have the H series.
Okay. If you say so.
I know. I didn't want you to have the same TV I did, Mike.
Oh, wow.
What? Did I say that? Damn you, second drink. But no, I'm sure the plasmas have, Panasonic made a really good plasma, so I'm sure it has this too. But like sharpness is, as a setting is fine, but when you can do horizontal and vertical sharpness separately, that's looking into the Mouth of Madness. Because I was like, oh my God, what if what I did here changed the other one? I had two, the other day when I was doing it on my TV, I had two remotes in my hand. So I had the Blu-ray player remote that I was like changing the menu settings, and then I had the TV remote changing the menu settings. Because there's times where like, I need to read the description on the Blu-ray. Okay, go back down. Okay, now I need to change this while I'm reading the description. Ah! I got really
good. So in your head, were you like, so you calibrated your TV first, right? You calibrated the TV first, and then you calibrated the settings for the Blu-ray player?
Well, the problem is you're always calibrating a Blu-ray player of some kind. Well, because the calibration is a Blu-ray disc.
Okay.
So technically, you're always calibrating for whatever player you're using.
Right, okay.
So I calibrated for the PS4. And I found that when I applied that to all the other inputs, it looked great.
Mm-hmm.
And then
Oh, God, we're going there, aren't we?
Bought a Blu-ray player I've been wanting for like 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
And it's sort of like if you ground up Jesus and put him on a chip and put him in a Blu-ray player.
Why would you do that?
Because you're Chinese, Jesus. And that's what they do. They make money off it.
Well, they do that with like whale testicles, but not Jesus.
Are you sure? Defend that statement. Sure? Prove it. Prove that the Chinese have not powdered Jesus and turned him into Blu-ray processing chips. Prove it. It's what I thought.
Can't prove it.
Yeah, We still have to name this drink by the end. Anyway, so that is such a legendarily, it's an Oppo, which is such a legendarily incredible processing, suite. Of the Blu-ray player, it has like a suite of different. You can get. I didn't do this, but you can get the Darby edition, which is a special version of it that improves the depth of field using a whole extra chip's worth of processing algorithms. And I'm like, I don't even know what that means. I'm not going to do that. But I did find that when I calibrated it the second time on a different input on the TV, because you can have two different calibration levels, I did have to calibrate it slightly differently for the Blu-ray. Primarily the sharpness. The PlayStation sharpens a lot better, I'm assuming because it's a gaming console.
Mm-hmm.
Which kind of makes sense when you think about it. So it's like the Jaggies. Like, it does as much post-processing it can to reduce that. So I had to up the sharpness levels on the new Blu-ray player because it's cinematic. It's not trying to do that by default. That's what you're asking, right?
Sure.
Okay. So what are we going to call this drink,
I think you've
Mike?
Lost everyone at this point. Yes. Naming the... I don't know. A darkened squirrelberry.
I really hate that name.
Squirrelberry? You don't like squirrel?
What about a darkened strawberry?
Too many
syllables?
Yeah.
Okay.
A darkberry squirrel.
Why do you keep inserting squirrel in the
because
worst...
Because that's the main ingredient.
But you're inserting it in the worst places. That's what I don't understand.
Well, where would you like to insert
if you're
squirrel?
Going to do... Just squirrelberry would be fine.
All right.
I don't love the name, but like darkened squirrelberry sounds like shit.
Okay. Well, we got to incorporate squirrel somewhere.
Okay, so there's no way we can incorporate squirrel. That's a good thing to know.
Okay, yes.
Okay, so squirrels...
Squirrel has to be in it.
So it's mandated by the creator of the drink that squirrel...
Yes.
Okay, good to know.
So it's got ginger.
Squirrel fields forever.
Squirrel fields... you don't like squirrelberry. I like squirrelberry, but I'm willing to give give that up.
If we... I'll take squirrelberry as the drink. It just doesn't put a good image or a good taste in my mouth. You know what I mean? Like, it isn't like if I saw that on a menu, I'd be like, I don't actually want to drink that because that sounds gross. Maybe it's just me.
A dark red squirrel?
What? Is this like the OK Cupid ad for a squirrel? He walked into the bar. He was dark red and a squirrel.
Straw squirrely?
Is that like Strasburg Studios? Yeah, man. Be straw squirrely, man. Searching for Zion. Dub styly. Za.
How about just Mr. Squirrelberry?
Why?
Why not? He's friendly. It's Mr. Squirrelberry.
He's a friendly.
He's got berries. And he makes you happy.
What about the Walmart?
The Walmart?
Wow. What about the walnuts?
What about the Walmart?
What is wrong with this country?
Man.
There's black walnut in that, too.
Yeah.
Which is why I
didn't
squirrel
walnut,
nut.
Black walnut, black squirrel, black on black squirrel violence.
Oh, God. I keep looking at the drink for inspiration, and it's giving me nothing. Ginger squirrel? Squirrel ginger?
Ginger the red berried... Ginger the red... The
black berried squirrel?
Ginger the red-headed squirrel
child.
Child.
All right,
ginger
I will...
squirrel.
Oh god. Ready?
Squirrelberry
or ginger squirrel?
Ginger squirrelberry.
No, that is right out.
Gingerberry squirrel.
Stop trying all those.
It's
words
like
with
swirl though. It's like gingerberry swirl, but then you have squirrel into the swirl. No. Dead rodent.
Yes! I would order that drink. Come on. You walk into Flight West, some hipster, awesome, like, reputation for their cocktails place, establishment, and you look at the menu, and you fucking see dead rodents as a drink. And then you read the ingredients. Are you not going to order that drink? I'm asking you right now, Mike, would you not order that
I'd
drink?
I'd probably order the drink. Okay. I probably would.
Ultimately, we're naming this for us.
Yes.
So, congratulations.
It's a dead rodent.
You have created the dead rodent, and it is fucking delicious.
And we are buddies in space. You are...
And Michael Carassi. You are...
S. Michael Smith.
And now we have Melanie's recorded bits, so she can play that.
We don't have to read that anymore?
We can take some time off.
All right.
We'll do the phone sex operator version of it.
Yeah. Sexy voice time.
Sexy voice.
Go.
Buddies in Space is a Stolen Dress Entertainment production. Visit StolenDress.com to check out other Stolen Dress podcasts, blogs, tweets, videos, and books.
Amazing.
Like it was always meant to be read.
Unlike how
we can't imagine anybody reading it any other way now.
No. Do you know that the my Call and Oates line is not only still around, but becoming popular again?
Becoming popular again?
I keep telling people about it, and they're like, this is amazing. And I'm like, don't fucking tell anyone about it.
Then why are you telling people?
I don't know. It's like part of me wants it to live on. But I have it so cleverly disguised in our system that like you'd never look at it and think, I need to delete this. This is clearly a joke. You know what I mean? Like just the way the programming is built. But I'm afraid that I've let so many people aware, like in on the joke now, that someone's going to bring it up to someone else and be like, oh, well, you know, corporate policy says you need to get rid of that.
Well, now it's on your podcast and everybody at work's going to know about it.
The Juon lady just killed them.